Well, let's turn back to those great stories of Elisha that are found in 2 Kings, and we're back in chapter 4, and we're going to look tonight at the two miracles that are described in verses 38 through to 44. Food, glorious food, hot sausage and mustard. While we're in the mood, cold jelly and custard, peas, pudding and saveloys. What next is the question. Rich gentlemen, have it, boys. Indigestion. That's what the great song in Oliver Twist, written in the 1960s, the musical, the film, one of those most famous songs, isn't it? Food can very often be a fun subject for us, can't it? We have endless food programs on the television now, don't we? Different chefs and Great British Bake Off. And food is something which is a huge industry, something which is part of the entertainment industry now. And there's always a danger, isn't it, when we come to these food stories in the scripture, that we forget just how serious a subject food is. We live in a land of plenty, don't we? One of the things we give thanks to God for is that we live in a land where we want for nothing. If what we want to buy isn't in Asda, well, we can go to Sainsbury's, can't we? Or we can go to Morrison's. We'll find it somewhere, won't it? The vast amount of food that we are able to enjoy. And even in the parts of the world today where there is a shortage of food, well, we can fly food in, we can send aid to eat. We live in a world, really, where nobody can starve. Nobody should starve, should they? Because there's so much food around. But food really in Bible times was life and death. If the harvest failed, there was nowhere else to go. There were going to be no live aids the other side of the world. There was nobody who was going to fly food in from Australia or from New Zealand or somewhere else. And when we come to these passages, we should remember just how big a subject food was. And here in this story, we have two great food miracles. It's interesting that a number of the miracles of Elisha touch upon food or water in one way or another. And we've already seen, haven't we, the miracle with the way in which the widow's oil was multiplied. And we've already seen Elisha's first miracle, how he cleanses the water in Jericho. These basic things, and yet they are of great importance. And these two miracles that we're looking at tonight, food miracles, are of great importance. And we're going to follow the same pattern as we are seeking to do with all of these miracles. We're going to look at the story itself in its 2 Kings chapter 4 context, 850 years or so before the birth of Jesus. We're going to look at these stories. We're going to seek to learn from them. That's what the New Testament challenges and commands us to do. What are the good examples? What are the bad examples? What are the spiritual principles with which we can grow in our Christian faith as we look at stories like this? But then we have to do something else, the New Testament tells us. These are they which speak of me, Jesus says. And so we have to search the scriptures and we have to jump 850 years to Christ and to see Christ as the greater prophet, as the one who is more than a prophet. And we have to learn the lessons about him that these passages point us to. Let's notice two things, first of all, then, about these miracles. And the first of those is that when a nation comes under judgment, God's people are not immune from it. When a nation comes under judgment, God's people are not immune from it. Now, when we begin to read the first story in verse 38, almost immediately in the second line, we come across the word famine, don't we? Elisha returned to Gilgal and there was a famine in the land. Now, in the Old Testament, whenever we see that word famine, we should think judgment. We should think covenant curse. One of the things that we know, I'm sure, as we go through the Old Testament, is that in many ways, the history of Old Testament Israel is the history of the covenant blessings and the covenant curses. In one sense, the whole of the Old Testament is a commentary on Deuteronomy chapter 28, we pointed that chapter again and again. You remember when the children of Israel were on the verge of entering the promised land? Moses knows that he can't go into Canaan because of his sin, because of his anger in hitting the rock with that rod and his failure to be obedient. God has said, no, you can't enter the promised land. You can go up onto the mountain and you can look down, you can see it, but you can't enter. And so the book of Deuteronomy there is Moses' farewell sermons. And in those, he reminds the people that they are the covenant people of God. And when they enter the promised lands, there are covenant stipulations. There are covenant rules. God has given them the law. And they are to be obedient to the law and faithful to him. And if they do that, God will bless them. He will send the rains in the season. He will send the sun at the right time. He will keep the enemies at bay. The people will have peace in the land that the Lord their God has given them. But if they break his law, if they go after the gods of the nations around, then there'll be covenant curses that will fall upon them. And the harvest won't grow. The rain won't come in its season. And the crops will fail. They'll hear the sound of the foreigner, the foreign tongue in their land. And ultimately, the ultimate covenant curse will be that they'll be taken out of the land and they'll go back into captivity. And that was what God said to them before they entered the promised land. And so when you see a famine here, whenever we read famine in the scriptures, in the Old Testament, we are reminded, aren't we? Famines were not agricultural events. They were not economic events. Yes, they were agricultural and they were economic, but primarily they are not those things. The droughts that have caused them, perhaps, are not meteorological events. They're theological events. They're about God. They're about God being faithful. Now, remember where we are. We're in the time of Elisha. You remember how at the end of 1 Kings, we have the story of Elijah, don't we? Do you remember how Elijah comes onto the scene in 1 Kings in chapter 17? The first thing, in a sense, that we read about Elijah is he goes before Ahab, doesn't he? And he pronounces the covenant curse. He says to Ahab, as the Lord God of Israel lives, before whom I stand, there shall not be dew nor rain these years except at my word. Why is that? Well, because Ahab has married Jezebel. And Jezebel has brought with her into the land the worship of Baal. And you remember some of the stories of Elijah, that great story in chapter 18, that great contest between Elijah and the prophets of Baal, and how Elijah proves, how God proves that he's the only true God. But you see, the people have gone away from God. They're not keeping their covenant duties. And so here we are again. And here is a nation, God's covenant people, they're under judgment. And that word famine reminds us of that. And you see, that affects God's people as well. It's great to see, isn't it, that there are, even in those times, there are still people who are faithful. There is this school of the prophets. We don't know exactly what the school of the prophets were, the sons of the prophets. They crop up in a number of places, particularly in these stories. Some people suggest that they were a bit like a Bible college, perhaps, a group of trainee people who were servants to Elijah and then to Elisha. But they're godly people, and they've not bowed the knee to Baal. Remember that promise to Elijah in 1 Kings 19, I've reserved for myself. People who will not bow the knee. Well, there are these people here. And then in the second story, there's this man who comes from Baal Shalisha. We don't know what his name was, but he brings bread of the first fruits. So there are still people who are keeping the law, still people who are putting God first. And even in these days of famine, there's this man who comes with his loaves and with his rice, doesn't he? With his grain in his knapsack. And so there are still people there, but God's people are suffering, aren't they? They're hungry. Yes, Elijah had that wonderful, well, it wasn't meals on wheels, was it? It was meals on wings. how those ravens used to bring him food while he was by the brook at Kerith, wasn't there, back in 1 Kings 17. But God doesn't do that for everybody. And here, these people are suffering. And they're going to extreme measures, aren't they? What are we going to eat tonight? There's nothing here. Cupboards are empty. Well, let's go out. Let's go out foraging. Let's go out and see what we can find. And so they go out foraging. It's interesting that we're doing this story while there's this amazing case going on in Australia, isn't it? In Australia, there's this case that's captivating everybody's attention with this woman who's been charged with killing three of her in-laws, is it? Or more than that, with mushrooms that she's picked that were poisonous mushrooms. And the question is whether she was trying to get rid of her parents-in-law and all these people. Well, here's the same situation in a sense, isn't there? They've gone out, and imagine if you'd been that guy who suddenly thought you'd come across this bush with all these wild grapes on. And you think, well, I'm going to be a most popular student in the college tonight, because I'm going to come home with my sack full of stuff. And they put in the pot, don't they? And, well, here it is. There's death in the pot, and the people think they're about to die. You see, well, why are they doing that? Well, because there's famine in the land, and God's people are not immune to it. You know, when God's judgment comes upon a people, there's not an inoculation that God's people can take which sets them free, which means God's judgment doesn't fall. You look in the second story, and again, we're reminded of some of the George Muller stories, aren't we? How remember George Muller, that man in Bristol who lived by faith with his orphanages, and very often the cupboards were bare, and then suddenly there'd be a knock on the door. The kids were sat around the table waiting for breakfast, and George Muller knew that there was nothing in the pantry that they could eat, and there's a man there. He's had a sleepless night. He's a baker, and he hasn't been able to sleep, and God has laid upon it his heart to bake bread for the kids there. And here's the Bible story, isn't it? This man just turns up, as it were, out of the blue, and he brings this bread, and he brings the grain. But you see, there's famine there, isn't there? And God's people are suffering because the land is under judgment. You know, there's a really important lesson for us there, isn't there? We were thinking this morning, weren't we? We were praying this morning. What an awful week it's been in the life of our land. And some of the things that we've seen that have been passed in Parliament, and some of the outrageous ways in which men and women are flaunting their sinfulness and their disregard to God and his word in his face. We see the crowds parading in their prides through Cardiff yesterday, and we wonder. Do you ever wonder why God doesn't pour down fire and brimstone upon us? The people of Sodom and Gomorrah must wonder, has God gone to sleep? Look at the sins that we committed, and this was the punishment we received. They must wonder why God hasn't done it to us yet. And you know, when God's judgment falls upon a people, God's people must expect to suffer as well. You know, if that is the case, if we're living in days when God has turned his back upon us as a nation, we mustn't expect to escape the outcomes of that and the things that happen. God is sovereign. God is holy. God is not to be messed with. This nation here is under the covenant people of God here are under judgment. And God's people are suffering too. But let's notice a second great thing about this story. And that is God is able to meet the needs of his people. And he meets the needs of his people sometimes in the most wonderful ways. We see the stories. We see how they work out. It's a great story, isn't it? The first story is a great story. And then we come on to the second one. That's a great story as well, isn't it? Here is the pot. All of these wild gourds have been put in. And the stew is bubbling away. And then it's served, isn't it? And We don't know exactly what's going on in verse 40, whether people are immediately feeling ill or whether it's something about the taste of what they're tasting, but they soon realize that what they're eating is inedible. And what they're eating is deathly. And there is this great cry, isn't there? It's wonderful to see what they do. They cry out to God. They cry out to the man of God, don't they? That's what we've seen in the previous stories. We saw it last week with the Shunammite woman, didn't she? When disaster strikes, when trouble strikes, where does she go? She goes to the man of God. She goes to the visible representation of God himself. These are still people of faith, aren't they? And they cry out to the man of God. And they say, there is death in the pot. And what are we going to do? They couldn't eat of it. Elisha comes. And he calls for some flour, doesn't he? And he brings the flour and he puts it into the pot. We're reminded, aren't we, of that story that began the Elisha miracles back at the end of chapter 2 when he takes that little bowl of salt up to the source of the water in Jericho and he puts the salt in. Salt and flour are both covenant materials, aren't they? They're both things that are part of the covenant meals of God. They're things that were part of the things that were offered to God in Old Testament times. And so there's a spiritual significance both of the salt and of the flour. And he brings the flour and he puts the flour in. And then he says, serve it to the people that they may eat. Now that takes a bit of faith then to eat it, doesn't it? If you'd been first in line and some was served to you, you've got to take a bit of faith now, haven't you? You've seen what it was like without flour. What difference is flour going to make? How is that going to change things? But of course it does, doesn't it? Because this isn't just MacDougall self-raising, is it? This is the flour of God's provision. This is God providing for the need of his people. And sure enough, we're not surprised, are we? Because this is our God. There was now nothing harmful in the pots. What's gone on here? Well, God has proven that he is God. God is sovereign in these things. As we said, in some senses, we might think this is a small thing. You know, last week, we were in 2 Kings 4, and earlier in the chapter, we were thinking about a little boy who died. And we might say, well, how small is this? But this is crucial. And you see, God is there, and God meets their needs, and God provides for their needs. And we see it in the same picture, don't we? In the next story. So here are these 20 loaves of barley bread, and there is this new grain in the knapsack. And here is God's provision, but is it going to be enough? Elisha looks around the table. There are 100 people there. And surely this is not going to be enough. It's impossible. How can you feed 100 people with just 20 barley loaves? But you see, God is the God who takes something small and he makes it great for the provision of his people. And not only do these 20 loaves feed these 100 people, but there is plenty left over. You see it there. They shall eat and have some left over. So he set it before them, and they ate, and some was left over according to the word of the Lord. Why is that? Because you see, God provides for his people. God is the only true God. It's interesting, isn't it, that Baal was the fertility god. Baal was the god that the people prayed to provide them for their food. The gods of the nations around, they both in Old Testament and in New Testament times, they're gods who could only do one thing, as it were, in the eyes of the followers. Actually, they couldn't do any of it, but you know how it was. That's why in Athens, there were all of those different idols, all of those different temples, those shrines to all these different gods. Because the Romans and the Greeks, they believed, well, there was a god for this, and there was a god for that, there was a god for this, there was a god for that. In Old Testament times, Baal was supposed to be the fertility god, the god who would give fruitful seasons. But he's not that, is he? Because there is no god other than the God of the Scriptures. There is no God other than Jehovah. There is no God other than the covenant-keeping gods. Baal can't provide the bread. He can't provide the food for the stew. Only the living God can do that. And he's the God who meets all our needs. All our needs according to his riches in glory by Christ Jesus. And again, you notice again how God just doesn't meet the needs. But there's this overflow. There is this some left over. There are the bags of scraps, as it were, that are collected at the end. Because God is the God of abundance. We thought about it this morning, didn't we? We thought this morning in 1 Timothy chapter 1, didn't we, about as Paul tells his story. And he tells Timothy, you know, there was a time when I was a blasphemer, a blasphemer. And I was a persecutor of the church. And I was an insolent man. He said, but there was God's grace to me. And remember we said this morning, it wasn't just his grace, but it was his abundant grace. And it wasn't even just his abundant grace, but his exceedingly abundant grace. That's our God. He's the God who meets the needs of his people, physical and spiritual. He's the God who is the God who's interested in the food that we need. We forget sometimes, don't we, that very first petition in the Lord's Prayer. Give me this day. Give us this day our daily bread. And we can cry out to that to our God because he's the God who meets all of our needs. It's a great story, two great stories in one, reminding us that even in the midst of a day of God's judgment, God is the God who provides the needs of his people. But then we've got to do the second thing, haven't we? We've got to jump forward. We've got to say, how does this point us to Jesus? And you know where I'm going tonight before I even have to go there, don't you? You see, this is a great miracle. And yet, as you read it, you thought, actually, this is a great miracle, but it's a bit small fry, isn't it? It's a bit like, you know, you've watched the coronation, perhaps, of the Queen in 1953. You watched it in black and white. Then you see it in color. And everything is much greater, isn't it? Much different. You actually see the richness of the robes of the people from the House of Lords or whatever. You see the gold of the trumpets, and you see all that. And you don't see it in black and white, do you? Because colors come. Well, Christ has come, the one who is greater than all the prophets. And we read about him, didn't we? And I trust you noticed how many parallels there are between this story at the end of 2 Kings 4 and the story we have in John chapter 6. And John chapter 6, I think John particularly, I think he's got this story in mind as he writes it. One of the great things about that miracle is that the feeding of the 5,000 is the only miracle in the Gospels outside of the resurrection of Christ, but the only miracle that Jesus performed that all four Gospel writers tell us about. That's interesting, isn't it? There are lots of miracles that are in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. There are lots of miracles that are in perhaps two of those. But the only one that's in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John is the feeding of the 5,000. That's interesting. It means it's a miracle we should really take notice of. Some of the features of the story, because it's four different reporters, four different people recounting the story, some of them tell us particular truths. Some of the particular truths are told us by all four, but there are some parts of the story that only one of the reporters tells us of. We shouldn't be surprised at that. If you were at a big football match yesterday, well, there'll be a report of it in the Times and in the Telegraph and in the Mail and in another local paper, perhaps, and the reports will be different because different people see it in different ways. And it's a bit like that with the gospel accounts. One of the things that John tells us that none of the other three tell us, is that they were barley loaves. They weren't just loaves. They were barley loaves. And that makes it like this story, doesn't it? There were a couple of other things that are clearly parallels to here, aren't there? There's this question, how can you feed people with just a small amount? it's here in verse 43. The servant said, "What shall I set before? Shall I set them before 100 men?" And of course, you remember in the story you have in John chapter 6, we've got a lad here with 5 loaves and 2 fishes. But what are they amongst so many? You have here at the end of the story, the collection of the leftovers, stuff that's left over. Elisha makes the promise, feed them and there'll still be some left over. At the end of the story in John chapter 6, we have the 12 baskets of fragments. And you can see the story is paralleled. But as with all of these stories, Jesus does it on a much greater level, doesn't he? So here we have 20 loaves and 100 people. So that is one loaf for every 5 men, isn't it? But in John chapter 6, we have 5 loaves for 5,000 men. Many people think it might have been, there might have been more than that. There might have been women and children there as well. But even if it was just 5,000, that's one loaf for 1,000 people. See, this is an even greater miracle, isn't it? It knocks the Elisha miracle, in a sense, into the shade. And we shouldn't be surprised at that, should we? Because Jesus isn't just a prophet. John chapter 6, that's what they say, don't they? That's what the crowd say. Again, I think John's got Elisha, the Elisha narrative in his mind. I can't prove that. We'll be able to ask him one day whether that was the case. But you remember how John tells us at the end of his account, those men, when they had seen the sign that Jesus did, said, "This is truly the prophet who is to come into the world." You see, he's far greater than Elisha. He is a prophet. He is the great prophet of our God. He is the prophet and the priest and the king. But he's much more than that, isn't he? He's God incarnate. He's the one in whom all the fullness of the Godhead dwells bodily. He's the one who says, "If you have seen me, you have seen the Father." He's the one that all the prophets have been pointing forward to. And unlike Elisha, he's the one who has come to bring eternal salvation to his people. Of course, there's something else that we must close with tonight. And that is to remember that in John's gospel, the miracles that John chooses to tell us are very few and far between. In some senses, you could almost say that there are only 7 miracles, 7 signs that John tells. Out of all of them, the end of his book, he says, "You know, I could have written many more of them. In fact, if all the things that Jesus said and did were written down, the world wouldn't be big enough for all the books." There were so many things. He's very selective. And many people have suggested that the 7 miracles are tied to the 7 I Am sayings. And this one certainly is, isn't it? Because after Jesus performs the miracle, and after they come trying to force him and take him to be the king, and after he escapes from them, and you have the story of him, of the storm at sea, and Jesus saying, "It is I, do not be afraid," and so on. Jesus walks on the water to them. The next day, Jesus unpacks the miracle, doesn't he? It's Passover time. That's something else John tells us. John's gospel is set around the Passovers of the earthly ministry of Jesus. And it's Passover time, and so the people are thinking back, aren't they? Thinking back to the events of the Exodus. And we picked up the reading again, didn't we, in verse 30. And the people come, don't they? And they say, "What sign are you going to do?" They haven't seen a big enough sign. They want more sinfulness of human beings. That God speaks to them in that way. And they want more, don't they? They want something even greater. And they come and say, "Our fathers ate the manna in the desert." They're thinking back to Passover, thinking about the bread that came from heaven, thinking about the manna that their ancestors complained about. But God sent us them all the years they were there in the wilderness. Jesus picks that picture up, doesn't he? And he says, "I say to you, Moses didn't give you the bread from heaven. My Father gives you the true bread from heaven." See that bread of heaven. That bread, that manna in the wilderness, yes, it met an earthly need for those people walking through the wilderness in their sinfulness and in their rebellion on the way to the promised land. But it was more than that. It was Christ. It was the picture of Christ. It was the type, the antitype of the one who would come. And Jesus goes on and says, my Father gives you the true bread from heaven. The bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world. Jesus says to them, I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall never hunger. He who believes in me shall never thirst. And you see, Jesus takes that miracle and he says, you know, it's pointing to me because I'm the bread of life. The food in the wilderness, well, it kept people for a day. They had to go out the next day and pick up the manna again. And eventually they all died, but I'm the bread of life. If you feed on me, I'm the living water. If you drink of me, you will live forever. And we read on in those wonderful verses, those great promises that Jesus made. All that the Father gives me will come to me. The one who comes to me, I will by no means cast out. This is the will of him who sent me, that everyone who sees the Son and believes in him may have everlasting life, and I will raise him up at the last day. How can Jesus make that promise? Elisha couldn't make that promise. Moses couldn't make that promise. But Jesus can, because he's the bread of life. And he would command us tonight to turn to him, to come to him. He would plead with us tonight to come, to believe in him, to put our trust in him, to feed upon him, to trust him not just for this world, but for the world to come. That great promise, he's not just here, as it were, to feed us in this life, but to raise us up at the last day too. My friends, as great as Elisha was and the amazing miracles that God did through him, here's the greater one, and here's the one in whom we must trust and trust all our days. Let's sing.